I believe what I am doing is good. And I believe what I am standing up against is evil.
That is Tim Naylor Foley, who heads a Citizens Border Patrol in Arizona. He's speaking to filmmaker Matthew Heineman in a scene in the Oscar-nominated feature documentary Cartel Land, a harrowing look at vigilante groups fighting the drug cartels in the U.S. and in Mexico, and one that ultimately moves you far from Foley's black and white view of the situation. Welcome back to WNYC, Matthew Heineman.
Thanks for having me.
You spent time with these two groups, Foley's Arizona Border Beacon and the Auto Defensas Group in the Mexican state of Michoacán. They're vigilante groups who step in because they think their government is either not doing enough to protect them in either case. Here's a little more from the film and Tim Foley again.
This is what I consider to be the Wild Wild West. There is nothing down here. There's no law. I'm supposed to be able to pick up my telephone and go, 911, come help us. But it's an hour and a half out of Tucson. What am I going to do sitting around for an hour and a half if I'm being attacked by the cartels?
So give us some context. Explain a little bit of what inspired groups on either side of the border.
Sure. So, you know, at the heart of this film are these two men, Tim Naylor Foley on the U.S. side, as you said, and El Doctor Jose Manuel Morales on the Mexican side. They're both 55 years old. They both believe that the government has abandoned them. They both, quote-unquote, taken the law into their own hands to fight for what they believe in. The circumstances of both men and both groups are quite different. Obviously, in Mexico, the violence is visceral. The violence is real. 100,000-plus people have been killed in the Mexican drug war since 2007. 25,000-plus people disappeared. Whereas in Arizona, that violence is much more theoretical. It's much more a fear that these Mexican drug wars will seep their way across our border.
On the Mexican side, you film survivors sharing horrifying stories of murders, including children. Can you explain how the cartels function there and can even bring themselves to do those things?
Yeah, you know, that's actually one of the things that really drove me to make this film is sort of trying to understand what would I do? You know, what would I do if my sister was raped or my father was hanging from a bridge? Would I take up arms? Is it okay to fight violence with violence? Is vigilantism sustainable? And that's why, you know, this movement rose up because they lived in a society where essentially institutions had failed. And the Knights Templar cartel operated with impunity. They controlled every aspect of civic society, from the judicial system to taxing everyone from local tortilla makers to multinational corporations, and kidnapping or beheading anyone that got in their way.
The leader of the Mexican group, the Auto Defensas, is a doctor, Jose Manuel Morales. And here's a little of him addressing a crowd. This is 17 seconds in Spanish.
El artículo 39 de la Constitución dice que el poder dimana del pueblo. Si ustedes están desunidos, cualquier pendejo va a venir a gobernarlos. Es importante que ustedes estén unidos.
The translation from the subtitles, Article 39 of the Constitution says power comes from the people. If you are not united, any idiot can govern you, so it's important that you all come together. That's what he said there for people who aren't bilingual. He concludes his speech with a call to take up arms. And watching these people take up arms to protect themselves does give a New Yorker insight into some of what motivates the fury over gun rights. What was your reaction to that, at least at first?
It's hard to make the connection between, you know, what's happening there in Michoacán, which is a world away. It's a world away from Mexico City, and it's definitely a world away from here in New York City, vis-a-vis gun rights. It was a very surreal world. I mean, you really felt like you're in the Wild West. People walked around with assault rifles governing the towns. You know, they had checkpoints. The Auto Defensas, as they made their way through the state of Michoacán, as they got rid of the Knights Templar cartel, really became the new law in town.
Where were the police? Where was the army?
That's what they're wondering. You know, that's why they did what they did. They were basically rose up to protect their families. You know, and this story is not unique necessarily. And this is a story that we've seen play out throughout history and play out throughout our world today. And we'll continue to see it play out as you know, people live in lawless societies and they feel like they have to take up arms to protect themselves.
As a New York-based filmmaker, how did you find these groups and get them to let you film?
So I read a couple articles. I read one article that led me to the Arizona story and another article that led me to the Mexican story. And right upon reading the second article about the auto defensas, I knew I wanted to create this parallel portrait of vigilantism on both sides of the border. What I didn't know was what I was about to embark upon, which was a crazy journey into the heart of this conflict. And, you know, I'm not a war reporter, but the film led me into some pretty crazy situations, shootouts between the vigilantes and the cartel, you know, meth labs in the dark desert night, places of torture, places I could never have imagined ever filming in.
Like there's this footage of the car you're in with some of the vigilantes coming under fire and gun battles. Were you in personal danger at any time? Looks like you were.
Yeah, you know, I mean, obviously, anytime bullets are flying, you're in danger. There's countless times when you know I feared for my life, and you know, it's a very, very frightening film to make. But I think for me, despite all of these really sort of adrenaline-filled, scary moments, I think for me, one of the scariest moments was actually an interview that I did with a young woman who was kidnapped by the cartel and saw her husband chopped up to pieces and then burned to death in front of her. And to be in this room with this woman and to look at her and to see a body that was there, but it was almost as if the cartel had sucked the soul out of her. Her eyes were deeply, deeply hollow. And to sort of hear her describe the horrors of what the cartel did to her and to think that we're the same species of human beings that would do that to other people, that sort of mentally stuck with me. Almost much more so than any of these more adrenaline-filled moments.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to the creators of all the Oscar-nominated feature documentaries, as we do every year. And my guest today is Matthew Heineman, who made the nominated film Cartel Land. Let's go back to the story for a minute. Dr. Morales, who we had heard the clip of in Spanish before, is injured in a plane crash. I'm not going to give away the ending, I promise. And leadership of the group passes to a man nicknamed Papa Smurf, and things change. And here's a little of what one of the group has to say during a raid.
Before all this, the Templarios, they're breaking into houses, taking money, stuff, even the dogs they're taking. So now when we get into this house, we're taking what belongs to us.
And heady stuff. Being armed and dangerous, whatever side you're on.
Yeah, you know, when I first went down to Mexico especially, I thought I was telling this very simple story of good versus evil, of guys in white shirts fighting against guys in black hats. But over time, you know, these lines became quite blurry and almost indistinguishable. And those who are fighting against evil started to become evil. And I think that's one of the, you know, most fascinating parts about the film is as things constantly changed and evolved. And you know, I ended up with a story that I never could have imagined.
And did you end up, based on what you just said, with a point of view that you never could have imagined about good and evil or about vigilantes?
You know, one of my mentors in the film world, Al Maisels, once said that if you end up with the story you started with, then you weren't listening along the way. And I think that's good advice for life, and I think that's good advice for filmmaking. And it's something that I carried with me almost every single day in making Cartel Land.
The main cartel, the vigilante group the Auto Defenses are fighting, are the Knights Templar, and they're also mixed up with the, did they say Viagras, named after the drug?
So the Viagras are allegedly a criminal group that emerges in the end of the film in this power vacuum that's created as the Auto Defenses beat back the Knights Templar out of the state of Michoacan. And so, you know, that's unfortunately, without giving away the end of the movie, what we see happen is that as they sort of clear the state, all these different evil forces try to take over. And that the name Viagra is actually named after one of the members whose hair is erect.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Thinking about those two names, Knights Templar and Viagras, Those names speak to medieval romance and modern pharmaceuticals, and seems they could be meant ironically.
Yeah, you know, I sometimes wonder, you know, whether they hire sort of PR firms to come up with some of these names. I mean, the Knights Templar is a fascinating and frightening organization that sort of believes they're doing God's work, that believes almost like the Out of Defenses, like they came into town to rid the state of evil, to bring order to the people, to protect the people, when in fact they did quite the opposite and reigned with a brutal hand and invoked unbelievable terror on the people. And that's, again, why the Out of Defenses rose up, and that's, again, unfortunately, why we see this cycle repeat itself in the film.
On that question of good and evil, the film starts with meth cookers in action in Mexico, with a young man telling you he'd rather have your job, but as long as Americans buy meth, it's what he'll have to do.
Yeah, you know, I fought for months and months and months to get into a meth lab, and it was on our final shoot, about 8 months into filming, that I got a call saying, be in this town square at 8 p.m. and you're in. And a group of masked men met us, and they led us into this meth lab in the middle of the forest. And, you know, it's a really important scene that we start in the meth lab and we end in the meth lab. And, you know, I think one of the elephants in the room in the film, you know, again, there's no talking heads in the film. It's a very experiential film. But I think one of the elephants in the room that the head chef in the opening scene alludes to is it's basic supply and demand. As long as there's a demand for drugs in the U.S., there'll be a supply of drugs coming from Mexico and South America. And with that will come the violence, and with that will come kidnapping and extortion and all the other things that the cartels do. So unfortunately, until we stop using drugs, this drug war and this cycle of violence will not stop.
So did you come to any new conclusions or revelations about what kind of policies would be best to fight these drug cartels, at least to eliminate the murder and mayhem that they cause?
You know, I'm not. My last film was on healthcare in the U.S., and I spent 8 months researching before I even turned on the camera. I really wanted to make a different type of film. This is not a policy film. I'm not a policy expert. I think one of the most interesting reactions, though, from the film is people coming up to me, and this happened dozens of times over the past year, bawling, crying, tears streaming down their face, saying they're addicts, and saying that their brother, sister, mother, wife, girlfriend had been begging them to stop. But for some reason, seeing this film, seeing this window into this world, seeing the violence that their personal choices were resulting in, had this extraordinarily profound impact on them.
With the uproar this year over Oscars So White, which is the hashtag for that conversation that everybody's having, we were thinking about our own category, the thing that we focus on this show, which is, you know, you folks who've created the Oscar-nominated feature documentaries. Documentary makers often choose subject matter about social or racial justice, but the filmmakers are mainly white. Is that a topic of discussion in the documentary world?
You know, it's definitely something that's discussed. Fortunately, unfortunately, I can't change who I am. I am who I am, you know, and I think I made this film. You know, I don't have any personal connection to Mitchell Kahn. I don't have any personal connection to the drug war per se. But I really wanted to shed light on this issue. And, you know, I felt like the drug war and this topic had in many ways been glorified in movies and in TV shows. And I really wanted to put a human face to this issue, not from the outside, but put myself right in the middle of the action.
Such a central thing to what makes any kind of journalism valuable. People like you who are interested in the world outside of themselves and outside of their own experiences. So no matter who you are, it's good that you made this film. What would it mean to you, and would it mean anything to the cause to win the Oscar?
You know, I'm at this point, I'm just incredibly honored to be nominated. You know, it's been an amazing journey with this film, and I'm extremely grateful that this nomination will help put a further spotlight on the suffering of the Mexican people and the corruption that allows this cycle to continue. Obviously, winning would be amazing and you know, further shed light on this issue. But for now, I'm just grateful for where we are.
Matthew Heineman, director, producer, and cinematographer of Cartel Land. It's streaming on Netflix. Good luck at the Oscars.
Thank you so much for having me.
We'll continue this series tomorrow with Joshua Oppenheimer, who'll talk about his Oscar-nominated documentary, The Look of Silence, the second of his explorations of the lingering effects of mass killings in Indonesia. Also, Mayor de Blasio joins us on tomorrow's show. Talk to you then. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.